Please be seated. This is number 50620, David A. Bollinger versus State of Nevada. If parties are ready to proceed, please do so.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, my name is Michael Pichetta. I'm appearing for Mr. Bollinger in this case. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. I certainly can't talk about all of the issues in the briefing, but let me start with one that I think is the most obvious, and that is the invalidity of the felony murder aggravating circumstances under McConnell. There's no serious dispute about that. District court found that they were invalid under McConnell, but found that the error was harmless and essentially irrelevant under Brown versus Sanders. This court has rejected applying Brown versus Sanders in Bejarano and Ripo, and so I do not think that we need to detain ourselves with discussing that. The problem here is, was the error prejudicial with respect to these aggravating circumstances? The verdict suggests, that in fact the number of aggravating circumstances did seem to make a difference. The jury found the three aggravating circumstances, the felony murder aggravating circumstances, plus avoiding lawful arrest and under sentence of imprisonment as to Ms. Holmes, actually everybody, we've all called her Mrs. Vertrees, but she had divorced Mr. Vertrees by the time of the offense. They did not find those aggravating factors as to the killing of Mr. Vertrees, on which the jury did not impose death, although they did find two mitigating circumstances. So it does appear that in this case, there is a likelihood that the number of aggravating circumstances made some difference. And therefore, under McCollum, and at least as an example, not as authority, under this court's recent order in the Wesley case, it is very likely that a different result would have obtained if those aggravating factors that are invalid had not been presented to the jury. Now,
could you elaborate on that? Why do you think that it is likely that a different outcome would have obtained?
As to, I can't stop calling her Mrs. Vertrees. As to the killing of Mrs. Vertrees, the jury found the three aggravating circumstances, including the three-part felony murder one.
I understand that you take felony murder out, but you're saying that this was prejudicial because, and you're analogizing to Wesley, and I'm missing why. That was a fairly unique set of circumstances.
Well, it was two murders with a different pattern of aggravating and mitigating factors. Here we have two murders, one of which, as to Mrs. Vertrees, the jury returned death, one of which, as to Mr. Vertrees, the jury didn't. The jury did not find any of the aggravating factors as to Mr. Vertrees. It did as to Mrs. Vertrees. It did not find any of the mitigating factors as to Mrs. Vertrees, but it did find mitigating factors as to Mr. Vertrees. Although the mitigating factors, an undefined other mitigating factor, and a lack of significant criminal history would have been the same relating to Mr. Bollinger as to either offense. So there, it is very difficult because, of course, we don't know what the jury thought. We cannot undergrope what the jury's actual thought process was. But among the differences between those two are the findings of the aggravating circumstances, which were different. That is, none as to Mr. Vertrees, three as to Mrs. Vertrees. I think that is a point from which we can depart to the next part of this analysis, which is what are the weight of the remaining aggravating circumstances. The under sentence of imprisonment factor is, we believe, was originally intended to apply to in-prison killings. That's not the interpretation that this court has put on it. But if the existence of a conviction regardless of whether the individual is incarcerated at the time of the homicide, is adequate to justify finding this aggravating circumstance. I think we would all have to admit that that is an extraordinarily broad aggravating circumstance that covers an enormous range of conduct. From, on the one end, Mr. Schumann, who was the last capital murder defendant under the old law to be sentenced to death, who murdered another prisoner in the Nevada State Prison while he was under sentence of imprisonment and in prison for life. The entire opposite end of the spectrum of conduct that we're talking about, if in fact this aggravating factor does apply, is Mr. Bollinger, who is on a suspended sentence on probation for a larceny. So in terms of talking about the weight that we give to that aggravating factor, because again, we're talking about a jury making the distinction between the many cases in which the death penalty is not imposed and the few in which it is, what kind of weight does that have compared to an in-prison killing by a lifer? I submit it's very different. The other aggravating factor is the avoiding lawful arrest factor. Now, I have waged an uphill and unsuccessful battle in this court on the proper interpretation of that factor. I do continue to believe that it should be reserved for an imminent arrest, and I would ask the court once again to consider doing a real statutory construction analysis and telling me why I'm wrong. But failing that, assuming that it does apply in this case, I think the court would have to recognize that factor is available in every single case where there's a felony murder. In this case, there's no evidence of any specific intent to avoid arrest by doing either of these killings. It's inherent, and if you look at the prosecutor's argument, it is basically, and this is the argument that the prosecutor makes, there's the existence of burglary, robbery, kidnapping, and therefore this killing had to have been to avoid or prevent a lawful arrest. So once again, although certainly a jury could find it, certainly a jury could go both ways, but what you're being asked to do, what the court is being asked to do, is to say, beyond a reasonable doubt, did these felony murder aggravating factors have no effect on the verdict? Finally, on this point, there's the question of considering the other mitigating evidence, including evidence of brain damage, classic mitigating evidence that was submitted in this proceeding, and that's at, it's described at pages 14 to 19 of the appellant's opening brief. I won't repeat it all at this point, but at this point, the court has to think, would that have had no effect on the jury's consideration? Now, I've cited a recent United States Supreme Court case, Porter versus McCollum, in which the court says, well, yes, you do have to consider all of the mitigating evidence, presented and unpresented, in considering whether or not a jury sentence of death can be upheld in the face of an ineffective assistance claim. I would also point out that in this court itself, in State versus Habersgrove, considered the availability of mitigating evidence that was not presented at trial. And although it was not with respect to mitigating evidence, but with respect to a faulty jury instruction, or an arguably faulty jury instruction, that this court did the same thing in Ripo versus State. In Ripo, this court had before it an appeal from the denial of habeas corpus relief in a capital case. There was McConnell error in that case. And in the course of analyzing the McConnell error, this court addressed the question of whether a jury instruction about the mitigating factors was erroneous or not. That jury instruction issue had never been raised at trial. It had never been raised on direct appeal. It had never been raised in the trial court habeas proceedings. It was not raised in this court. It was brought up by this court sua sponte and decided on the merits. So if this court could, in under the circumstances of RIPPO, revive a completely defaulted issue under all of the default rules that have been presented in this case, and consider that in connection with resolving the question of harmlessness of McConnell error, why can't it do that for Mr. Bollinger? And I submit that that is precisely what this court should do. It should consider the mitigating evidence, the powerful mitigating evidence that was not presented previously in connection with the McConnell error. And on that basis, I think it cannot find that error harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. I think I do need to say a couple of words about the Byford issue here. This is a case where we really have no good evidence about how these killings actually occurred. We just don't. There is a statement that Mr. Bollinger supposedly made to a jailhouse snitch. The jury was free to reject that, as the prosecutor argued it should. We really don't know whether the theory of first-degree murder by premeditation and deliberation was considered and relied upon by any of the jurors. And in fact, in the course of the guilt phase deliberations, there was a question about whether premeditation was the same thing as intent, which is, I think, a strong illustration of exactly the problem that Byford found. I recognize this court has said in NECA, Byford will not be applied retroactively to these cases prior to its issuance. But I think that leaves two questions that this court has not responded to in NECA or in subsequent cases. One is, the statute has never changed since 1862. How can we say that between the time of Casolin and the time of Byford, that this court simply eliminated statutory elements of the crime and then put them back? I submit that that is not a theory on which we can deny retroactive effect to Byford, because this court eschews judicial legislation. But I think more important, we have the question that this court did not address in Byford or in NECA or subsequently. Between Casolin and Byford, as Byford acknowledged, we had jury instructions that did not make a rational distinction between first and second degree murder, that erased that distinction. So for that period of time, we have a death penalty statute which applies under state law only to first-degree murders, but we have a murder statute that doesn't make any distinction between first- and second-degree murder. And on that basis, I'd ask this court to consider, does that really hold water as a way of not giving retroactive effect to Byford? I submit that that is an unsustainable system, and that, therefore, this court should apply the Byford rule to Mr. Bollinger's case. And if I could reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, counsel. I want to start off with the idea of waiver, and then I'm going to try to go back through Mr. Bollinger's arguments, but as you know, this man was convicted in 1994, and then this court affirmed his conviction in 1995. He filed his first habeas petition in 1996. It was denied. In 1998, this court affirmed the denial of the district court's order denying his first habeas petition. That was in 1998. In 2005, he filed his second habeas petition. And right before the hearing on the second petition, Mr. Bollinger and his counsel and the prosecutor and the court sat down in the courtroom and said, let's narrow the issues. What's this hearing all about? And the district court judge asked Mr. Bollinger, now, as I understand it, you're challenging the effectiveness of your trial counsel and your penalty counsel. Is that correct? And he started to say, yes, but the district court interrupted him, asked another question, and he said, I don't want to challenge the effectiveness of my counsel at the penalty phase. And she explored that further with him. Mr. Bollinger told the district court judge no less than 7 times he did not want to challenge the effectiveness of his counsel at the penalty phase of his trial, or that he didn't receive the ineffectiveness of counsel at the penalty phase. He told the trial, so the canvas continued, and it was an extensive canvas, and you have it, you can read it, you've probably already done so. He told the court 5 times that he had had the opportunity to discuss this. In other words, waiving the effectiveness challenge to the penalty counsel. 5 times he told the district court that he didn't want to do that. 3 times he told the district court that he had had enough time to discuss these issues, or 3 times that he understood he could not raise any habeas issues regarding the sentencing phase later on in habeas proceedings or on appeal or in any form whatsoever. Mr. Bollinger has never alleged that that waiver was invalid because he was coerced or he didn't understand what was going on. In fact, his argument on appeal now is that that was a procedural aberration. I don't know what that means. He says, well, there's nothing under our statutory law that permits such a discussion, such a waiver. There's nothing that prohibits it either. The court was merely trying to refine the issues between the parties. And he said no less than 7 times he wanted to waive any challenge to the effectiveness of a sentencing counsel. And the other argument is that, well, that waiver is a result of ineffective assistance of counsel. Well, we simply don't know that. That's never been litigated. So our position is that that waiver in and of itself has legal force and effect, aside from the procedural bars. He knowingly entered into, or he knowingly waived all of his right to litigate any procedural difficulties with his counsel, any substantive issues that should have been brought forward in the second habeas petition. And that is aside from the procedural defaults in this case. And that's also true. That waiver also applies to any cause to overcome the procedural defaults, such as good cause and prejudice or actual innocence that they want to argue overcomes the procedural defaults in this case. So that's the first thing the court has to decide, is whether a waiver existed, whether it's valid, and whether it covers all of the issues in this case. Because the waiver, if it's valid, would also cover the McConnell issue in this case. Because if the waiver is valid, then he has no right to challenge even the invalid aggravator under McConnell, where the felony aggravator was alleged both as an aggravator and as a liability for first-degree murder in this case. So, going on to Mr. Bollinger's first argument today, and that is that under the McConnell issue, the first argument, our first argument, of course, is that that was waived. But his first argument is that the district court's analysis is wrong because the district court relied on Brown v. Sanders. And this court, according to Bollinger, said that Brown v. Sanders did not apply in the Ripple case. And that's just absolutely wrong. It's absolutely wrong. And if it's wrong, then you can reject his argument in total. Because what happened in Ripple, this court said that Brown v. Sanders does not apply if it's trying to be used to bring in evidence under an invalid aggravator under the rubric of other matter evidence. As you know, other matter evidence can be introduced in death penalty trial, but only after the defendant has been found eligible for the death penalty. And we can't bring in other matter evidence before that into the eligibility question because this court in Ripple said that would skew the narrowing process. But the court expressly said in Ripple that we could bring in evidence under Brown v. Sanders under a proper rubric or another proper rubric of an aggravating circumstance if there was another aggravating circumstance in the case that would allow the evidence that would be excluded under the improper aggravator that was struck. So that's exactly what happened, and that's what in the district court. And the district court ruled that, okay, if we strike the McConnell aggravator, which was the felony murder aggravator, that he committed a murder during the course of a robbery, a burglary, or a kidnapping, he suffers no prejudice because that evidence is going to come in under another valid aggravator in this case, which was that he committed a murder to avoid arrest. And that's exactly what Brown v. Sanders said is permissible, and this court said is permissible in Ripple.
Are you not troubled by the inconsistent sentences, though?
The inconsistent sentences? Justice Cherry, this court on direct appeal addressed that argument. That argument was...
I wasn't here.
What, excuse me?
I wasn't here.
Okay. On direct appeal...
I don't mind.
I appreciate that. On direct appeal, this court said, because they raised the issue of inconsistent verdicts, the court in essence said, this guy is just lucky because there's all the evidence in the world shows that he was eligible for the death penalty for both victims, and the evidence in this case would have authorized the death penalty for both of the victims. And that the court said the only way we can read the record is that the jury decided to grant this man clemency.
But you're making short shrift of Mr. Pichetta's argument about less aggravating circumstances with the striking, even though we've also said it's harmless.
The argument is, first of all, the argument is the McConnell error is waived by what Mr. Bollinger did before his second hearing. The second argument is that even if the invalid aggravator, the felony murder aggravator, is struck, nothing changes because all the evidence under that aggravator can be properly considered under the aggravator that he committed a murder to avoid arrest. That aggravator, committing a murder to avoid arrest, was presented by virtue of the fact that the reason he committed these murders is that he kidnapped the victims and... he did the kidnapping in the course of a burglary, and he robbed them. And it was also presented on the fact, as this court said, that he committed those crimes, or that he committed the murder to avoid arrest for having committed those other felonies, a robbery, burglary, or a kidnapping. Because the evidence showed that he took the mobile home. We don't know if the victims were in it or not, but that he hit Mr. Vertrees over the head with a pipe in Reno, and then he kidnapped the victims in the mobile home while in Reno, and then he went to Colorado and wherever else in between with the victims in the mobile home. So it's a fair inference to argue that he committed the murders after he had already committed these felonies. And if he did so, he did so to avoid arrest for the murder. So the same evidence would all come in under a valid aggravator, and if all of the same evidence comes in, even though you only have two instead of three aggravators, nothing changes. And if you reweigh this like the district court did, you can say beyond a reasonable doubt a jury would have returned a death verdict.
It's tough for me to reweigh because I've been in the trenches on these cases, and I know how important it is that you have less aggravators.
Fewer aggravators can make a difference.
Make a big difference.
But
I'll go this with you, too. I'll say this to Mr. Pichetta also, that it's not necessarily once somebody's death qualified, it's also the what you call the other matters that is devastating to a criminal defendant in the system that we have. There's no doubt. And I see what you're talking about.
Well, and that's
you're
our
absolutely
position.
Right on that, about the brutalness of this particular type of crime.
All of this evidence that would have been excluded under the felony aggravator still comes in under the avoiding arrest aggravator. Brown v. Sanders says so, and this court in Ripple says so. We take just an opposite position of what Mr. Bollinger argues Ripple stands for. As far as the Byford argument goes, Mr. Pichetta, of course, concedes that his argument has been rejected, and again, we follow suit that it has been rejected, and we ask the court to continue its holding in NECA.
I'll follow our stare decisis in this one. I don't have a problem with that.
The other issue is that counsel was ineffective for failing to present other mitigating evidence in this case. Our argument, of course, first is that Mr. Bollinger waived his opportunity to do that. This court has consistently said, maybe most recently in Pellegrini, that the court is consistent in the application of procedural default rules. The court has said that those rules are mandatory and that the habeas statutes are designed not to give petitioners several opportunities at habeas relief. Despite that, petitioners keep arguing that the court's inconsistent in its application of the rules, that they're not mandatory, that petitioners can have a number of chances or opportunities at habeas relief. Well, this is a chance for the court again to affirm what it said in Pellegrini. The default rules are mandatory. They're not discretionary. And if he waived his opportunity at having these issues presented in a second or in a first petition and at the second hearing, he's provided to show good cause and prejudice for being allowed to go forward again. Now, the argument is that, according to Bollinger, there's actual innocence, according to this new mitigating evidence, and that overcomes the procedural bars. That turns on the question of how do we determine actual innocence in the context of a death penalty case? And our argument is that one is eligible for a death penalty sentence, and therefore to show actual innocence, only if he can show that all of the aggravators are invalid. Now, I recognize this court has said otherwise in a number of opinions. The court has said that eligibility for the death sentence turns on two things. There has to be a murder conviction and at least one valid aggravator, and the mitigating circumstances must not outweigh the aggravating circumstances. But I think what the court has used that language, it has only used that language to say that is when a death penalty can be imposed by a jury. It has not said that in a literal definition of what it means to be eligible for the death penalty. Because when we're talking about eligibility for the death penalty, we're talking about two things. The United States Supreme Court has said you need two prerequisites for a constitutional death penalty statutory scheme. You need an eligibility process, and you need a selection process. The eligibility process involves the idea that we want to narrow the class of people who are eligible for the death penalty. And that's what an aggravator does. It narrows the class of people who are eligible for the death penalty. Weighing mitigating circumstances and aggravating circumstances does not do that. That is a weighing process for the jury to decide whether they will impose
Mr. Plater, I asked your colleague this morning to comment on the Ninth Circuit court case in Deutscher. I recognize, I think that's been withdrawn, but it does seem to suggest that the Ninth Circuit feels that in weighing states, eligibility occurs through weighing.
And we think otherwise. We think eligibility occurs when there is at least a valid aggravator that is proved, and of course a conviction for murder. And the reason for that is the analysis used in Kansas versus Marsh. Like I said, the Supreme Court said that there are two requirements for a valid death penalty statutory scheme. There is the eligibility process and there's a selection process. Eligibility involves this idea that we want to narrow the class of people who are eligible for the death penalty. That's what an aggravator does. But the weighing circumstance of aggravators and mitigators does not do that. That goes more properly to the area of the selection process, because that's the process where the jury is required to consider mitigating circumstances relative to the defendant and to the crime that he's committed. So when you look at the two functions that have to be fulfilled in a statutory scheme, it seems like eligibility would just require the validity of one aggravator as opposed to the weighing of circumstances of aggravators and mitigators, which is more akin to the selection process. And that makes good sense, too, because we want objective assurances when somebody is valid or is eligible for a death sentence. It's very difficult to rationally review mitigating and circumstantial mitigating circumstances on review. But we can review that. That eligibility process if we look at whether there was a valid aggravator.
Well, there are many cases where there's eligibility, but selection saves the defendant.
Selection saves the defendant
from death
because of what he's able to present.
Right.
So for those reasons, we'd ask you to affirm the district court.
Thank you. Bichetto?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm not going to have enough time to say everything about how I disagree with Mr. Taylor on some of these issues. Brown versus Sanders dealt with a very different system. The California system, you have one special circumstance that advances you in, that's found in the guilt phase, that advances you into the penalty phase. Everything else, whether it's called aggravated circumstances or whatever it's called, that was what the Supreme Court was dealing with in Brown versus Sanders, and the question was whether the jury could consider something that underlay the special circumstance as part of the selection determination. That's not the question here. I don't think we can look rationally at the language of our statute and say that as soon as you have an aggravating factor, you're eligible. This court said clear as daylight in Johnson versus State, you need two things. You need one or more aggravating factors, and you need a finding from the jury, a unanimous jury finding, that you that the aggravating factors are not outweighed by the mitigating factors. As to the waiver issue, which I think is very important, there was, and this is alleged in our petition, there was no effort by post-conviction counsel to find any of this mitigating evidence. At the point where Mr. Bollinger was making these assertions to the district court in the first habeas proceeding, he was not making a knowing and intelligent waiver because no one had done the work that would have shown him what there was to present as mitigation. The law is clear that a decision made without adequate investigation prior to it is not a knowing and intelligent and counseled decision. Especially as to the, if I could just finish for 1 second, Your Honor. As to the question of waiving the McConnell issue, if you look at the respondent's answering brief at page 14, what they are referring to in the briefing is the question of the mitigating evidence. They don't say the McConnell issue is waived. And if you look at this, there's an unpublished order by this court, which I'll be happy to furnish to counsel, called Charles Randolph versus State, in which this court addressed a McConnell issue over the objection of Mr. Randolph and his counsel. So the idea that the McConnell issue is waived by this unknowing attempt at waiver in front of the first habeas court is, I think, groundless. And let me just say, is in answer to Justice Pickering's question earlier, if you look at the other aggravating factors that were at issue in the Wesley case, depravity and a prior violent felony. What we have with Mr. Bollinger is no prior violent felony. All we have is a larceny and no other criminal activity. And the brutality in Wesley was multiple stab wounds. As to the question of the difference between the verdicts, consider, we don't know what the jury thought. The jury could have thought Mr. Vertrees was complicit to some degree in this. He, after all, was in jail for kidnapping with use of a deadly weapon when he allegedly met Mr. Bollinger. When he came out to reunite with Mrs. Vertrees, she had divorced him, she changed her insurance. The motorhome, which they owned together, was basically facing foreclosure. We don't know if Mr. Vertrees was to some degree complicit in any of these offenses. So the question about whether these aggravating factors made a difference is a very alive one. And I submit that it prevents this court from saying beyond a reasonable doubt that the result would have been the same in the absence of these invalid factors. Thank you, Your Honor.
I would thank counsel for both sides for their arguments this day. These are areas that are of great concern and interest to this court. With that, this matter is submitted.